And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Corey White. In 2014, Corey White performed his debut stand-up show, The Cane Toad Effect, a staggeringly personal story of his experience growing up in foster care, surviving domestic violence, recovering from drug addiction and dealing with mental illness. He handled this material with a deftness and humour that far exceeded his experience, and it garnered critical praise and winning Best Show at the Sydney Fringe, the Best Newcomer Award at 2015 Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and then he took his show to the Edinburgh Fringe. Corey continues to perform and advocates for change for kids stuck in our dysfunctional foster care system. Corey, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So, Corey, the trauma you went through as a child, I mean, there are some parts where you almost don't want to look. It's the stories you describe are so graphic. But is that, and that's led to you now speaking to these large audiences in Australia and overseas. By opening people's eyes, do you think you've finally become that superhero you dreamed of becoming as a child?
Oh, that's a very good question. I don't think so, but I think that I've become happier and I do feel connected to, I guess, the larger community by being able to tell my story and by, you know, working very hard on myself. I guess I hope to make sure in whatever way I can that this doesn't happen for other children.
Well, you became a foster child when both of your parents were still alive. Do you think that the authorities tried to keep you with one or both of your parents? Did they try hard enough?
I think they perhaps tried too hard. My father was often in jail, and we were returned to my mother repeatedly, and she was not by any stretch of the imagination ready to be a mother. She was struggling with heroin addiction and sort of presided over a household in which there was, you know, some pretty hairy stuff going on, and she would often sort of up stumps and leave and do drugs with friends, and we would be alone in the house without food for days. So I think in some sense the department, you know, returned us too soon to our family, and without trying to counsel or provide assistance to my mother. So, yeah, I think maybe too keen.
You would say it's not always a good thing to strive to get the kids back to their biological parents in as against, you know, farming them out to a foster parents.
Yeah, I think that should be our first preference, of course. But, of course, there are situations where I don't think that's really appropriate. And certainly not without significant counselling and support for the parents who are having the children returned to them.
Yeah, it's a difficult question, isn't it? I mean, what do you do in these situations? Because it in your case, it wasn't just the parents. I mean, you had problems with the biological children as well. I mean, that's putting it mildly. So would they have to be vetted as well?
Well, I mean, the idea is that they are. Of course, the system is quite under-resourced, some might say broken, and unfortunately the monitoring and regulation that should go on doesn't. But yeah, there should be a vetting process in place.
Because as a result of your situation, would you say it had the effect that you had to grow up fast and you had to develop things like cunning that you don't expect of, say, a 9-year-old child?
Yeah. Well, I think there's two kind of contradictory things going on. There is a sense in which, as a child, you grow up very quickly, but in a sense, you are also arrested developmentally because you don't go through normal periods of challenging authority or feeling safe, which are critical to, you know, shaping a holistic sense of self and coming with the ability to regulate emotions and handle stress. So I did grow up quickly in some ways, but in other ways I was completely behind the eight ball, particularly emotionally.
I suppose there was one aspect of your parents that, as you say in the book, at one stage, you know, they had fairly low expectations of you. I think as long as you weren't a policeman, you were sort of ahead.
It was sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing that, the good thing about having parents that are pretty, low on society's respectability registry is that, you know, there's a lot less pressure on you as a kid. And that's very much just a joke that I've made over the years.
Well, of course, that is the amazing thing. I mean, it's someone described you as being seriously funny, because a lot of the topics you cover,
traditional comedy topics. There's no airline food material. Yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, to talk about a dysfunctional foster parent raising is hardly what you'd sort of have a joke over
Seinfeld.
The dinner table.
Seinfeld never did it, did he?
That's right.
What's the deal with the foster care system?
Yeah. Well, and now now you are an expert, and you can it's not really seeing the funny side of it. It's I don't know what it is. Is it part embarrassment when people hear your stories?
No, I don't think it's embarrassment. I think that there are a lot of different reasons people laugh, but I think maybe the reason that elicits the largest laughter is the release of tension, to somehow address people's deepest stresses and concerns, and to show that it's okay. I think lets out so much anxiety. It's like, you know, when someone that you love falls over and for an instant you think that they've really hurt themselves and then you realize they're okay. You often just laugh very hard at them because there was that tremendous buildup of anxiety which suddenly dissipates. And I think I do that when I talk about topics like death and suicidality, child abuse, and all of these other topics. People are so ready to laugh at those topics when they're brought up, because they bring with them their own sort of fuel. And when you leave those topics in a way that surprises the audience, lets them know things are okay, all of that tension immediately turns to laughs.
Yes, it's not a matter of identifying, because I think I've seen part of one of your shows where you say how many in the audience have gone to visit their mother in jail. And
Which is just an absurd question. Obviously, there's a whole class thing at play here, and no, they haven't, because stand-up comedians usually play to audiences that are quite middle class.
Mm. And that is the amazing thing, as far as I'm concerned, that where did you get that confidence from? Because normally the kids have been through what you've been through, I would imagine, would have a severe lack of self-confidence. But, you know, you come across so confidently on the stage.
Well, I mean, that's partly just being a stand-up comedian for so long. You just, you know, you're good at hiding nervousness, or perhaps you don't feel it so much. That's just professional skill, I guess. But I think my parents, despite all their flaws, were in some ways very loving to me, did fill me with a sense of self-belief. And I think that's carried on into my childhood, up and down. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a whole aspect to it where, especially in the show that you're referencing, I was just trying to just be honest and speak plainly. And I think that gives you confidence, knowing that you just want to say, you know, very basic things in a way that you hope people find funny. And then that kind of gives you enough self-belief to just do it.
You say at one stage in the book that in a funny kind of way you are grateful to Tracy, who I think was perhaps one of the worst foster parents you had. Why would you say that you could still be grateful to her?
Well, I talk about it in the book, and it's difficult because you spend so much time articulating these nuanced things in the book. So it's always challenging to describe, you know, why on the fly for an interview. But in brief, I think that prior to living with that particular foster carer, I mean, I was headed for a life of violence and aggression. I'd taken after my father in a lot of ways. And, you know, I was subjected to some pretty awful abuse and cruelty in Tracy's home. And those things were terrible. But there is a silver lining in that I feel that they turned my rage from going out into the world and turned it back inwards to myself. I stopped being angry and I started being depressed. And, you know, if I had to choose between the two, I speak about this and I weigh this sort of ambivalence that I have about that in my head. I talk about that in the book. But I think that I would prefer to be depressed than the raging, furious boy that I was.
And we're speaking today with Corey White, who is the author of a new book called The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. So it is a strange title. I guess you'd expect that, but it doesn't sort of indicate much of a future, I suppose, if you're talking about a horse in the glue factory.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. That's grim. I sort of cooked it up because I thought it was, you know, it was kind of morbid and funny to me. And I also think that it actually captures some part of a major theme running through the book, which is the idea of trying to win or be successful in a doomed system. There's no point in trying to be the prettiest horse in a glue factory if you're going to die. And I think for a lot of my life, I was chasing after things to fix me. But those things were never going to fix me. And in fact, those things were quite destructive.
And we might take a short break there. We're going to listen to a beautiful but sad song. It's by a group called Racing Cars, and this is a song from 1977 called They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Sense, but we'll stay here too.
And that was They Shoot Horses, Don't They? By Racing Cars. Today we are speaking with our special guest, Corey White, who is the author of a new book called The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. Corey, one of the things that I imagine would have been very difficult was you were constantly being tested when you went to new foster homes, and you're saying you were feeling depressed, or you had all these feelings, but I guess you had to hide that and present the best face so that you get the gig.
Yes, which is not unlike going into work hungover and just putting on a brave face, you know, except you're a child and you have to do that. Yeah, certainly there's this sense that's quite intuitively felt and known by children in care that you are to some extent performing for those who are caring for you, and, you know, you feel like at any time, and often, you know, it happens, so you think this way, at any time they could just get sick of you.
It must have been a dreadful pressure. I mean, one of the joys of being brought up by your natural parents is that you can put on a tantrum, but you know they'll still be there. They'll be there tomorrow.
I've heard rumours about this. That sounds like a wonderful system. I mean, I don't know what to say. I think that, that's quite obviously true.
Well, one of the turning points, because you had a number of turning points, I guess, but one of the big turning...
The book is filled with turning points, yeah.
Yes, it is. It's and sometimes frustratingly so, because, you know, you seem to be on the right road and then some other dreadful thing will happen and you're back where you started. But,
yeah.
I mean, one of the good turning points, which sort of stayed that way, was when you were about 16 and you went to Nudgee College in Brisbane.
Yeah.
But even then, I mean, was it hard for you as like, I guess you call them scholarship children or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
You're put in with all these rich kids.
Yeah, I mean, no, I actually don't think that was hard at all. I feel like it was a tremendous blessing and gift. To me, I was suddenly, by association, part of a world of wealth. And, I mean, I overestimated it, being given this scholarship to a boarding school. I had this idea that everybody would be wearing monocles and tuxedos at all times, I think, on some level. And, of course, the reality was a little different to that. But I really enjoyed it. I worked very hard. It was a struggle. But I always saw it as a marvelous and tremendous opportunity, which I had to grab with both hands, and I did.
Yes, I mean, that, as I say, that was a good turning point, and it's great that you can still look back on that now and see that for what it was, that was a really good thing for you. And then you study very hard, and then you kept up that study motive you got into university on a scholarship. So and then you did very well in the first year of uni. So another good part.
Mm-hmm.
But then. Then it all went downhill again when you succumbed to some other temptations, and so once again it was this roller coaster ride. And you must wonder what would have happened if you'd stayed at the university.
Yeah, I don't think that I was really in any state to stay at the university. I think, you know, the problems were beginning to rear their head, and the dive or descent into addiction was just one particular form that descent took, but I think that descent would have driven me from university, regardless of whether I went to do drugs. I think it was the very early stages of, you know, existentially feeling and realizing the trauma of my childhood. It was the beginning of a breakdown.
And then it sort of turned around again. I mean, I thought you had quite a novel reason for giving up drugs. We can thank McDonald's for that, I suppose.
Well, not McDonald's, but yes, we can thank potato jam manufacturers, definitely.
Because yes, well, the problem being that you nearly choked to death, I suppose. So yeah, that seemed enough of a reason to get off the drugs finally, which you know I think it must have been a good thing. But also about that time, you got that great suggestion from a friend. I mean, that just seemed to come out of nowhere, and then you found yourself on the stage.
I started doing stand-up comedy, and you know, it gave my life meaning and purpose. People often ask, oh, you know, did it save your life and things like that? And I'm always hesitant to sort of be too mawkish or sentimental about stand-up comedy. I think I write in the book that I feel, me finding stand-up comedy felt like a short man discovering you can be a jockey. Like, it just seemed like a great fit for my problems, you know what I mean?
Mm.
It seemed like I was built for it. There's a particular gig that I do write about, which I think is very funny, and people have responded to amazingly, and it really shows the arrogance of youth, I suppose.
Now, there was another good story coming along, which was Chloe. But then once again, was it your tough upbringing that affected that relationship, do you think?
Yes, of course. I think, you know, I think the way that we're raised as children, as science increasingly shows, is such a strong and often inescapable pattern for how we relate romantically throughout our life. And I don't think you can really have healthy relationships after a childhood of trauma until you fully confront and heal that trauma, and that was definitely the case in one of my relationships. But there's a lot of real beauty in that relationship, and what I share in the book, a lot of humour, and just a lot of you know, some really wonderful moments. I think it's probably the story, you know, the whole part of the book about Chloe is perhaps one of my favourite parts of the book.
Yeah, it is, and another major turning point, I think. I think your aim now is to raise awareness of injustices in the foster care. What do you see as the priority? Which injustices should we be focusing on?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because you don't want to spread your energies too thin. It's hard to be really precise in what you're saying. I mean, personally, I have done a lot of advocacy, but I'm hoping to sort of get involved in the policy areas and sort of try to be in the room, you know, with government officials and things like that, because I think that is ultimately the most powerful chance we have of improving the system. But for the average person, I think being aware, it sounds sort of a bit naff to say that, but, you know, talking to friends and family and raising awareness of issues, sharing, you know, some of the very, very shocking things that do happen, because I think the only way or one way that the system will change is for a sort of democratic widespread shift in public opinion to occur, and that requires awareness. And I think people don't know a lot about the foster care system. I think there does need to be more awareness to put pressure on media and put pressure on government in particular to change things. So I think, you know, just watching out for these things and introducing friends and family to the problems in the system is a really great start for anybody.
It seems to be a bit of a mixture. I mean, I'm aware in my family where my uncle very generously took a foster child for weekends and school holidays, and I caught up with that foster child recently, and of course he only speaks very highly of what happened and his foster parents and all the rest of it. But then on the other side, you've got the fact that foster parents are paid, and that looks like an easy way to make some money by, you know, less scrupulous people. I'm not sure how you deal with that.
Yeah, I think you've really hit the nail on the head there. To get enough foster carers in, you need to incentivize it. But of course, that does mean that it can be exploited. I think one way of dealing with that is to, you know, have social workers who work for the state level departments of child safety to be better resourced. At the moment, you know, they are so overburdened, they're forced to constantly act in an acute, reactive way. Were there more social workers to manage the caseload of children in care, I think that would have more time to monitor and regulate and weed out those unscrupulous foster carers. And, I mean, in addition to that, perhaps and I don't know exactly the details of how this would work, but I think, you know, just really listening to children and you know, having our ear to the ground about potential cases of abuse inside the care system.
That's difficult too, because at one stage you had a chance to speak about one of your foster parents and you felt pressured to keep saying the right thing. I mean, somehow yes. We've got to open it up so those foster children can speak openly and honestly, I guess.
Yes. It's in the nature of people who are treating children badly to manipulate those children. I mean, also around that time, you know, even though I did feel pressure, I was barely seeing social workers. And I feel like if a social worker was present, then they would have been able to pick up on some signs. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because they're probably not being paid a lot of money, but you want these people to be sensitive and intelligent and everything else to, you know, to make sure the right thing's being done by the children.
Well, I mean, I hardly think they're paupers, a social worker. You know, it's a well-paid government job. You know, they'd be getting paid quite well. But I think they are overburdened. Rates of attrition among social workers are extraordinary. So you have people graduating from university with a social work degree at 20, 21. And, you know, within 2 or 3 years of working at a department, the Department of Child Safety, they're burnt out and they quit in droves. And that, to me, these are young people full of energy at the beginning of their professional careers. Right, they're 22. I mean, I'm 31, and I'm doing okay. I've got a lot of energy. But for a 22-year-old to throw their hands up, I can't do this anymore, that, to me, speaks very, very badly of the system.
So, look, there are a lot of issues thrown up in this new book by Corey White called The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. It's told with Corey's trademark wit and wisdom, and it just really remains for me now to give a special thank you to Corey. Corey, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Oh, thank you for inviting me to talk with you. I really appreciate it.
Look, it's great, and it's terrific to hear. Well, we'll stay with the horse analogies. It's great to hear something straight from the horse's mouth. So,
very nice.
Don't forget, we'd love to hear from
anybody. You've been waiting to say that, haven't you?
I have. There have been a few things I've been waiting to say.
You thought about that line a week ago, and you were like, I'm
going to
say that. That was great.
Oh, you found me out. Look, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.